From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And let's get right to South Florida, which is preparing for Hurricane Irma. The storm remains an extremely dangerous Category 5 hurricane, according to the National Hurricane Center, with maximum sustained winds now near 175 miles per hour. The storm could hit South Florida this weekend. And today, Florida Governor Rick Scott said no resource or expense will be spared to protect the state.
Every Florida family must prepare to evacuate, regardless of the coast you live on. We do not know exactly where this storm is going.
For more, let's bring in Wilson Sayre, reporter with WLRN in Miami. Hi, Wilson.
Hi, Jeremy.
And parts of South Florida are under an evacuation order, but we spoke with your colleague in Key West who said many people there are ignoring that order. What about where you are?
Yeah, I mean, some people are listening. That doesn't necessarily mean they're leaving South Florida. They're finding friends and family who live farther west, away from the coast. Like many analysts have said, this is going to be a storm surge issue, not necessarily a rain dump
right.
issue. So people farther away from the coast hypothetically are safer. But there are still a lot of people leaving. 75 and 95 northbound are bumper to bumper. It's taking hours and hours and hours to get out of South Florida. And it's not just people in South Florida who are looking to leave. There's people up in Jacksonville who are leaving, people on the West Coast who are leaving because we don't know where the hurricane's going to hit.
And the governor is expected to activate the entire Florida National Guard to prepare for Irma. He's also calling for volunteers. Tell us about the state response.
Yeah, there's 4,000 National Guard right now. The rest will be out tomorrow. The Red Cross has been called in, and they're setting up shop. One of the big issues has been having enough fuel, and so Governor Rick Scott has asked surrounding states to lift their weight restrictions on trucks so they can get more gas down here so people can fuel up. You know, FEMA was just deployed in Houston. There's been a lot of concerns about the availability of funds, but Scott says there will be as much need as there needs to be. So everybody's sort of on ready alert.
And then there are people, of course, who don't have cars. Let's listen to Eugene Johnson, who lives in an affordable housing complex in Miami.
Well, I have no transportation, so I have to depend on other people to bring me water. So I got a friend who said he's going to bring me some water.
What are authorities doing about people like Eugene Johnson?
Yeah, I really have to give credit to my colleague Nadege Green for making sure this is part of our coverage because so many people in South Florida are not of means. And hurricane preparation costs a lot of money to go to the store, to idle, to spend extra money that you might not need. And so a lot of people are sheltering in place. They're hoping their friends will bring them something. I asked the mayor of Miami-Dade County this yesterday, and he says, you know, you don't have to go out and buy the bottled water. You can turn on your tap.
Right.
But a lot of people are concerned that's not enough. So the shelters are there for people who absolutely need them. The hope, though, is that most people will be self-sufficient for at least 72 hours if they are in one of the non-evacuation zones. So for people who can't afford to prepare like they're being recommended to, shelters are sort of where the officials are telling people to go.
And just a few seconds left, but this would be the first major hurricane to hit Miami since Andrew in 92. But there are a lot of new building codes, right?
There are new building codes, but those are for new buildings. There's a lot of old buildings that didn't get affected by Andrew that still exist. Hmm. It looks like it's going to hit farther north. And so we don't know how those buildings will fare.
That's Wilson Sayre, reporter with WLRN in Miami. Wilson, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, people leaving their homes before the hurricane hits have to prioritize what to take with them. Essential items, medications, clothing, and for some families, diapers. Toddlers use 6 to 8 diapers a day, and infants can go through a dozen. In Texas, where many are in shelters after Harvey, diapers have been crucial. Courtney Collins of KERA in Dallas reports.
Hermonique Lowe left Galveston County the Thursday before Hurricane Harvey hit, not knowing what would be left after the storm passed. And she did it with a 3-month-old. She says living in a Dallas hurricane shelter with an infant is no picnic.
So it's kind of stressful because the baby's crying. You know, the baby's stressed out too because, you know, we're in a new environment. So.
And unlike traveling with an adult or an older child, trekking north with baby Jameer is a lot more work, Lowe says. Housing a baby takes a lot of supplies.
Diapers, wipes, Similac, clothes, bibs. I mean, we have to travel with all that.
something that's hard to do when fleeing a hurricane. And Lowe isn't the only one with diapers at the top of her list. Mother of five, Daphne Griffin from Port Arthur, says being able to change your baby into a clean diaper is a need, not a want.
They can catch rashes, they can get infections. You gotta have it. Like, you have to have diapers. And like right now, we have a virus going around the center, so diapers are going extremely fast.
Griffin's nine-month-old, named, believe it or not, Stormy, caught that virus.
But she's going through almost 22 diapers a day.
And that's what makes keeping diapers stocked after a disaster so challenging. You can't ask babies to ration them, and it's impossible for evacuees to bring all they'll need while they're displaced.
Diapers are specifically a problem because, first off, families go through, you know, babies use a lot of diapers, so the space and the need for those is constant.
Joanne Goldblum is CEO of the National Diaper Bank, an organization that connects corporate sponsors and community groups to provide diapers for people in need. Right now, that means sending truckloads of diapers for babies and adults who need them to disaster areas. Goldblum says babies are obviously happier and healthier when they have enough clean diapers to get through the day. What people may not understand, she says, is that goes for moms, too.
We know through research that we did with our colleagues at Yale that maternal stress and depression are highly correlated with diaper need.
And the need isn't just where the storm has been. Shelters set up in unaffected areas like North Texas are desperate for stock, too.
Many people evacuated and are in the surrounding communities, and they have great need because they left with the clothes on their back.
That's what Daphne Griffin did, more or less. First, she gathered up her mom, dad, husband, and five kids. As far as supplies, she grabbed what she could, but had no idea how long she'd be gone.
We were on bottles, diapers, clothes. Didn't think that we were going to need a lot than what we brung, and the little that we did bring, we run out of really quick.
National Diaper Bank CEO Joanne Goldblum says most evacuee families are in the same boat.
What we say here is small things impact big things, and something as small as a diaper can make a difference.
And she hopes it will, because people who have lost homes and cars and are struggling to put their lives back together shouldn't have to wonder where their next package of diapers is coming from. For Here and Now, I'm Courtney Collins in Dallas.
Well, let's go from Texas to the western U.S., which is seeing smoke blanketing entire states. In Oregon, which has the largest wildfires right now, the Eagle Creek wildfire has covered around 31,000 acres. Amelia Templeton is a reporter at member station Oregon Public Broadcasting. Amelia, we understand that only a small percentage of this fire is contained. So what's it like there?
Well, conditions today are a little better. The temperature has dropped. It's getting humid. That's calmed the fires down a little bit. But there are thunderstorms forecast for today and tomorrow, and they're not expected to drop much rain. And that could mean more lightning, shifting winds, new fire starts.
Yeah. And talk about what it's physically like. We're reading about people wearing, you know, face protectors.
Yes. A lot of people have compared this to what it was like after the Mount St. Helens eruption. On Tuesday morning, I woke up at 5 a.m. to the sound of my home fire alarm going off. That was how thick the smoke had gotten in Portland. And this morning, I noticed that my tennis shoes are still coated in ash. And just to give you a sense of the scale of this fire burning near Portland, it jumped the Columbia River, which is the biggest river in the Northwest, more than a mile wide in places.
Right. So there you go. That's big. And a few hundred people evacuated.
More than 500 people have evacuated their homes. There's also a fire burning in southwest Oregon that has forced hundreds of evacuations. So serious impacts. And at this point, the fire is also starting to approach the boundary of the watershed that Portland gets its drinking water from. So one of the very significant long-term impacts could be if the fire crosses into that watershed.
Yeah, and we said, you know, these are health considerations. There are people, as we said, covering their nose and mouth because it's difficult to breathe in some places. And reports say that police believe this was started by a teenager using fireworks.
Yeah, we've actually interviewed a couple of eyewitnesses to that event. And the Oregon State Police have said it was a 15-year-old boy from Vancouver, Washington. But really, it was, as we understand it, a group of teenagers who were playing with smoke bombs, allegedly tossed one into the canyon and then hiked out as the fire started and actually trapped 150 other hikers on that trail.
Were they rescued?
Yeah, they were had to spend the night out overnight, completely unprepared, but they were eventually rescued and taken out sort of on a back route. I was actually there the morning that they brought them out, and, you know, there were a bunch of people just dressed in bathing suits because it'd been a hot day, and a lot of people had gone to that trail because you can swim there. There's swimming holes, and they, you know, had to sleep without really, you know, any supplies. And they talked about, I mean, the craziest part was having to stop brush fires as they were hiking away from the fire. Wow. These little spot fires would start, and they would take their water bottles and they would douse the little spot fires to keep the fire from surrounding them, basically. So,
wow. Amelia Templeton at Oregon Public Broadcasting on the Eagle Creek wildfire. It's now covered, as we said, around 31,000 acres in the northwest part of the state. Amelia, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And we're going to take a break from the news for a moment. We've learned it will be there on the other side to make way for our occasional and sometimes irreverent listen to classical music. I don't know about you, but I hear the first chords of West Side Story and I am a jet or a shark or Maria. The revolutionary musical burst onto the Broadway stage in 1957 at the end of the McCarthy era. West Side Story was composed by Leonard Bernstein, who'd been on Senator Joe McCarthy's blacklist, along with Arthur Lawrence, who wrote the story. It was choreographed, though, by Jerome Robbins, who named names and helped create that blacklist. And all of the men were closeted gay men, when being gay was even less acceptable than being a communist sympathizer. Fran Hoffner says there's lots of interesting reasons to check back in on Bernstein. Fran writes the Classical Music Hour column for The All. She joins us from WBEZ in Chicago. Fran, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
Okay, you can be forgiven maybe because you were born 6 months after Leonard Bernstein died in 1990. Mm-hmm. But truly, yeah. You only recently saw the 1961 movie?
Yeah, in full, yeah.
Well, as you write, leave me alone. So you got to it. But we have we have the story of Tony and Maria, the Romeo mm-hmm. and Juliet of the West Side. What do you think?
Oh, it's amazing. It's such a fun time. We saw it with, a full audience who knew everything and loved everything, And it was a blast.
Well, let's talk about the music. Bernstein, born in 1918, middle-class mm-hmm. family in Massachusetts. He met composer Aaron Copland at Harvard. Copland became his mentor, conducted the New York Philharmonic before he turned 30. And as you write, he was about high and low art smashed together. Remind us.
Yeah, I mean, he represented this sort of melding that existed in the 20th century where someone could come from a middle-class background but then go to Harvard and be this genius composer that also made popular classical music for the masses that people could understand and immediately have such an intense emotional reaction to, like you said up top.
Well, and you played it as a teenager and a timpanist, mm-hmm. so yeah. You know how percussive it was. Let's listen to Cool Fugue from his West Side Story Symphonic Dances, which is a compilation of some of the pieces. This is when they're getting ready for a big brawl and a gang member is, telling everybody to be cool. Let's listen. Describe that musically.
Well, what I love is that there's such a sharpness to it and an urgency. It's really direct. It's kind of straight into your nervous system. There's no room for things to be as broad and spacious as they were in, 19th century romantic music. It's the 20th century. everyone's driving cars. They have to go. So the music has to be quick and still manage to keep people, have people keep up with it.
Well, as you write, you know, the vibes, the piano, the freaking brass, the symphonic dances, all of them are essentially one big brag. Look at how good my music is that I stripped it down to make it more obvious. Excitement!
Yeah, my adrenaline's like already going just listening to that.
Yeah. Well, as you remind us, Bernstein, famous for popularizing classical music with his young people's concerts. Mm-hmm. But you point us to another Bernstein. Look, I had a hard time watching this video that's, we'll link listeners to it, herenow.org. I also could not stop watching it. It's from a 1985 PBS documentary, the recording of West Side Story with opera stars. And you have the young Jose Carreras, you know, the Spanish tenor.
Who's amazing, by the way.
He's amazing, but he's not good enough for Leonard Bernstein, who you also see wincing, just making these expressions like he just can't bear what Carreras is doing as Tony. Let's listen. This is take 130.
Could it be? Yes, it could. Something's coming, something good. If I can wait, something coming, I don't know what it is, but it is gonna be grand. With a click, with a shock, funnel jingle, donald, open the lock.
You're ahead of me. Pepe, watch me, not the music. And if you make a mistake, we'll go back. Right? You know this. When you look at the music, you sing wrong words. Just look at me.
Oh. Well, it's just the classic, are you rushing or are you dragging sort of debate, and he's speeding through it. It's so tough to watch.
Let's listen to a little bit more.
131.
Coming to me.
Could it be? Yes, it could. Something's coming, something good. If I can wait, something coming.
What I'm saying, coming.
John, please don't do this. Don't give elocution lessons over the microphone, okay?
You know, it's a perfectionist with someone who is almost perfection, you know?
Yeah.
But not quite. You say this scarred you as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a kid and you're watching this, he seems like maybe one of the scariest people you can imagine. So I probably saw this documentary just by chance of being a kid who watched a lot of PBS and seeing this. And then I think maybe a decade later, finally saw these children's concerts. And I'm like, this is that mean guy from that documentary channel. I know, but now he's nice. I mean, he's really tough, and it took a lot of years in development as a musician to also understand that, like, Carreras is rushing. Like, he's got to get it right.
Yeah. And Bernstein was right. Here's another video you found of him giving some young musicians that have joined an orchestra that's also doing a recording a lesson on the triangle that he's looking for. And listen closely. Hear what he keeps saying and then what the player keeps playing. Let's listen.
Think it up. I don't know where, but play higher on the triangle. I'm not a triangle specialist. But one. No, it sounds like the doorbell. I mean, it could be anything. I don't know how to tell you to do it, but do it. One. Yeah, it's worse.
Yeah, it wasn't the diggity-dum that he wanted. It missed
the
diggity.
No, it had to be higher.
Yeah, it had to be higher, and it missed the T of diggity or something.
Mm-hmm.
Back to West Side Story. We heard some of the percussive pieces that just jolted you out of your seat. Mm-hmm. And the others just, you know, the lyrical ones broke your heart. One hand, one heart. Let's listen.
Only death will part us.
Make of one.
friends, speak to that music.
One Hand, One Heart is an interesting piece of music because it was something I had not ever really connected to before I put it together with the film. I had always been kind of like a little eye-rolly about it. I was like, this one's a little sort of saccharine. And in the grander context of West Side Story as a musical and as a movie, it really is heartbreaking by that point because he's built up so much of that urgency and tension and then allows, you know, the two romantic leads to have their time. Mm. And he knows how to use that time when he has it.
Boy, and he does it again in Somewhere. Fran Hoffner, she writes the Classical Music Hour column for The All, and she says, hey, check out Leonard Bernstein.
Yeah, he holds up.
By the way, we know some schools have not put it on, but looking at it with a modern eye, some are wondering if it's racist. Just, you know, listen for the music. Fran, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today, Amazon announced its plans to build a second headquarters for North America. The Seattle-based company says the new location could cost as much as $5 billion to build and run. For the cities and states bidding on the project, being picked could mean tens of thousands of jobs and other economic gain. Lynette Lopez is senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. She joins us from New York. Lynette, to start, Amazon made the announcement today they're accepting proposals until October, which is not that much time. How unusual is this kind of bidding process for a company?
This is very strange. This is almost like Willy Wonka announcing his golden ticket prize. Mm. The whole approach is odd, but Jeff Bezos has brought a lot to Seattle. There are 40,000 people employed there, and they make $25.7 billion in compensation. So any state or city would be happy to have Amazon headquartered there. And they're probably going to give them a lot of tax breaks to attract Amazon.
I'm sure that they will. I mean, do we have any sense of what kind of tax breaks or other incentives Amazon might be looking for?
We know that they got over a billion and have gotten over a billion in breaks in the past. They are planning a New York warehouse. They say they're going to hire 50,000 people there. In this location, they say they could potentially hire up to 50,000 people as well. Hmm. But this is going to have a range of employees there, from programmers to logistics people. So it's going to have to be somewhere where people are very educated, somewhere that has, say, an international airport. But they're looking at urban and suburban location. So it could be, you know, I've been seeing a lot of talk on Twitter about Columbus, Ohio's prospects. You know, never
interesting.
Know.
What kind of impact has Amazon had on Seattle?
The company says that it's brought just less than $38 billion in investment to Seattle. Employees of Amazon have given $43 million to the Seattle transportation system. And from the thousands and thousands of hotel rooms that Amazon and its guests rent, I think in 2016, it was 233,000 hotel rooms in Seattle for, you know, Amazon employees. It's crazy. It could completely change the face of a town or of a state.
Well, and I'm sure a lot of towns and cities are going to be getting into the mix for the second Amazon headquarters in North America. We did see this morning the Wall Street firm MKM Partners predicting that in the next decade, Amazon could be worth triple what it is today.
Yeah, it's a massive company. And the thing about it is that Jeff Bezos has taken a very different approach to the company than I think some of his competitors. He doesn't really do stock buybacks. He doesn't really care if the stock price goes up or down.
Right.
He's not always trying to show a massive profit. He takes a lot of what he makes and then reinvests it back into the business. He's not afraid to try projects and fail. And it's a very experimental company, but it has had its doubters along the way, especially on Wall Street. There's this argument, do you let the finance guys run your company or do you start with a product first? And Amazon has always been a product first company. And it's showing that that kind of laser focus can make you a winner in this marketplace and you don't just have to rely on the bean counters on Wall Street.
And as a full disclosure, we should note that Amazon is among the financial supporters of NPR. That's Lynette Lopez, senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. Lynette, thanks.
Have a good one.
So what happens if Congress does not pass a law protecting DACA, the program that defers deportation for young people brought to the country illegally by parents before 2007? Or if President Trump doesn't review DACA again, something he tweeted he would do if Congress doesn't take action? What happens if young people who came to this country as children or infants, 79% of them from Mexico, with no memory of their native countries, are deported and sent back? Well, we already know. The Mexican government said it will welcome these so-called dreamers with open arms. And Israel Concha echoes that sentiment. He is co-founder of New Comienzos, or New Beginnings, a nonprofit in Mexico that helps Mexicans, including dreamers who've been deported, repatriate. He joins us now by Skype from their very busy office in Mexico City. Hi, Israel.
Hi, Robin. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. And, you know, this is just such a funny thing for Americans to try to wrap their arms around. We have organizations here who help immigrants and migrants and refugees who come across the border. You are trying to help Mexicans going the other way. First of all, what do you think when you heard that DACA had been rescinded?
This decision affected almost 800,000 dreamers. But think about it. Most of them have already finished their college. They're working. What about their parents? This decision has affected millions of people.
Well, you say what about their parents, but people are wondering what will happen to the children of dreamers, children who are born in the United States and who are American citizens. But you already know, as we said, some of the things that might happen because you have had people who are in the DACA process, who are qualified as dreamers, who had been deported, because we want to remind people that in order to qualify for the DACA program, which gives a work permit and a Social Security number, you can have a criminal record. And we're reading anecdotally about some dreamers. For instance, one had a fight with his wife. The neighbors reported it as a dispute. The wife didn't charge, but still that was seen as an infraction, and he was deported. Are you coming across those kinds of stories?
Yes, Robin, this is very common nowadays here in Mexico City. As a matter of fact, we have identified about 10 dreamers that were repatriated in Mexico without a criminal record. So yes, it's a very big problem right now.
Because these are people who were promised deferment from deportation, and for some reason, they have been deported. But what's it like for them? I mean, describe some of them. Do they speak the language? Do they have family there? What's their situation?
Think about it like this. You've lived in America all your life. You're pretty much an American. You're used to the system. You went to school over there. Your first language is English as well. And then you're deported. You come to your country of birth, but in reality, you have nothing in common. We've encountered many repatriated people, especially dreamers that don't speak any Spanish. And besides being discriminated against in America sometimes, this also happens here in Mexico because of the way they talk, the way they dress. Fortunately, now there's a light by the end of the tunnel. There is some help.
Well, tell us about it. What do you do? What do you do to help these people?
Yes, we help with psychological help. We also help with jobs. We also give you food vouchers. So at least that day you're going to interview, at least you can have something in your stomach. We also work with many shelters that can help you in emergency situations. And we can help you from the ID process, so you can get a Mexican voting card, or if you have to get your driver's license, even recommend the favorite pizza place in town. But it's more of a big brother, big sister program as well.
Yeah.
But besides that, we're also working with other government agencies that can help, also with Spanish grammar classes, culture and history classes, because a lot of us have never been in Mexico, or maybe when we were younger. So we get an opportunity to learn about the culture here, the history, and the opportunities out there.
Well, you say us, and that's because you're also a deportee. You were brought to the U.S. illegally when you were 4 years old, raised in Texas. Then before you could get into the DACA Dreamer program, you were pulled over for speeding and deported, sent back to Mexico. What was it like for you? Did you know anything about Mexico? And you left at four.
Well, I can tell you that when I was going to school, elementary, junior high, high school, I always knew that I was undocumented. But that never stopped me. Even though I lost many opportunities because I did not have a legal status, I was still able to graduate from college, business administration. I started a transportation company, limos, shuttles, concierge service, taxi cabs. As a matter of fact, I was employing U.S. citizens. We were so busy one day where I actually had to pick up a customer. And yes, I was speeding. But unfortunately, what would have been a speeding ticket for anyone else, for me, that's where my nightmare started. I got pulled over. I couldn't provide a driver's license. And at that moment, I was sent to county.
Well, you fought this case, but you were one of those who had hands and ankles shackled and sent back to Mexico. What did you lose when you were deported?
I fought my case for 2 years. 2 years I was detained in a federal facility without having a criminal record. And remember, my story is one in millions out there. There's a lot of people suffering because of this immigration broken system. My wife, well, my ex-wife, she was 5 months pregnant. I was not able to meet my son. I only met him once, and that was at a court hearing. And yes, he was so close to me, but yet so far, because I was not allowed to touch him, kiss him, hug him. And till this day, the only contact I have with my family is through Skype. It's very unfortunate.
So you are deported. You lose everything, the business that you built, your house, your family. Dropped off at the border by a bus near Laredo, Texas. How did you feel in that moment? And how does that help you now with the dreamers that are being deported and those who might be down the road?
Well, I never cried when I was detained. For those 2 years, I tried to stay strong. But at the moment when I was dropped off at the border, I started tearing up. My whole life just passed by my eyes, just knowing that I was not going to be able to see my family, that I was going to lose my business, my house, all my stuff, you know, but especially being away from the family. Being repatriated, you go to a specific section where the government actually gives you a document that proves that you were deported and that you're a Mexican citizen. After that, a lot of people, they try to go to the closest bus station so they can get to their final destination, right? So it was about 15 people, and we started walking towards the bus station. Well, the police stopped by and started interrogating us. Where are you from? I was getting arrested. My hands were handcuffed again, but they also covered my head. Unfortunately, I was not going to the police station. I was being kidnapped.
Well, what a nightmare. I mean, you were able to get away from that situation. We should tell people you found a job at a call center. You're now helping others through your organization who are deported. But what do you say to the Americans who say, good, you know, send all 800,000 back? It didn't matter that they were children and had no, you know, say and that they were brought here. It was illegal.
Well, they may have taken away our legal status to stay in America, but they haven't taken away our pride, our willingness to fight, our hopes and dreams.
It sounds like, too, that it doesn't take away your feeling like an American.
Of course. Once again, that's all we know, America. And we're very proud people. And we do believe, even though it's not on a piece of paper, we do consider ourselves American. So once again, we have to look at the cup half full. We're really hoping that now this time Congress and the United States president can pass a comprehensive immigration reform, can help this sector of the population. Now, we are getting ready for the worst. If for some reason thousands of people have to come back to Mexico, we want to work together with government agencies at the federal and local levels so we can help as many people as possible. I was able to create a system, an interactive system that looks for specific words throughout the internet, like repatriated, bilingual, need a job, and automatically the people that are looking for these services are connected with us. We've been able to help over 3,300 people, and that's with many services.
That's Israel Concha, co-founder of New Comienzos, New Beginnings, the nonprofit he founded that helps others who grew up in the United States be repatriated after they're deported to Mexico. Israel, thank you.
Robin, thank you very much for your time, and greetings from Mexico City.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's get back to our top story. Hurricane Irma, which has caused major damage throughout the Caribbean. Ricky King describes the scene on the French side of the island of St. Martin.
The country is devastated, worse than what we have ever witnessed before. We had Louis, but it's nothing like Louis. Louis times, we had shacks, but in this time, we have well-constructed structures. Roofs gone, house, even concrete house fell down. So you can imagine the impact that we had with that thing.
The latest track still has the storm hitting South Florida this weekend. Jack Seiler is the mayor of Fort Lauderdale, just north of Miami. Mayor, how are you preparing for the storm?
Well, we started preparing about 3-4 days ago when this storm started to surface out in the Atlantic. We started preparing, and this is nothing new to the city of Fort Lauderdale. We've been dealing with storms for, you know, our 100-plus year existence. So, you know, actually, we feel like we're ready. We feel like we're prepared. And more importantly, we feel like because of our early start that we've got all our neighbors and visitors prepared, and that's important.
How many people have already evacuated, or do you know?
Well, from the traffic, from the gas stations, lines, you know, it seems like a fair amount of people are heeding the warnings and moving out of the low-lying areas. But because of our experience with these storms and because of the fact that, you know, we've been through this. We went through this last year with Matthew, that our neighbors and citizens are very good about heeding warnings and about following their, you know, orders. And more importantly, from my standpoint, about making sure they're helping their neighbors. I mean, we've had an amazing outpouring of just good people doing good deeds. And, you know, that goodness shines through sometimes in the darkest moments. And we're seeing it now in preparation for this hurricane.
What are your biggest concerns in a city like Fort Lauderdale, which is low-lying but also has some pretty tall buildings?
You're right. I mean, we have a, you know, downtown urban center that's one of the most successful business centers anywhere. And we've got, obviously, an airport and a seaport, both, you know, very large, very successful.
But right next to the ocean, too, right?
Right next to the ocean. You're correct. But and then you also got to look at all, you know, our tourist destination. We have dozens and dozens of hotels, high-rise hotels. So, yeah, we're an urban area with about 1.8 million people. But my biggest concerns now are storm surge and the wind. You know, everybody's kind of been focused on what happened in Houston, and it was a tragedy. But we're seeing that Houston was a huge water effect, huge rain effect. We're more concerned about storm surge. If the storm surge comes with a high tide, and the storm surge comes with a strong wind out of the east, that's going to push a lot of water in the low-lying areas. That's not necessarily rain. That's the ocean coming up. And so that's a huge concern of ours. And then secondly, the wind factor. You know, we do have tall buildings. We do have a very developed downtown and a very developed barrier island. And the wind is something that we're very sensitive to. So part of the message we've been talking about is check your yard, check your neighbor's yard, you know, check the construction sites and the properties in the city, and make sure we're not leaving any hazardous materials there, any possible projectiles, things of that nature, because, you know, we've got to kind of all keep an eye out to make sure we don't create any hazardous conditions or damage after this storm. And so we've really emphasized that people need to be aware of their surroundings and aware of what their neighbors are doing.
We're already seeing airlines winding down flights at airports in South Florida. Are you worried about people getting stuck in Fort Lauderdale?
No, we're not. I mean, like I said, again, we've started early with this message, and we've been educating people and informing people. So we've seen a lot of people driving out, you know, 995, the Turnpike, I-75. You know, we're seeing a lot of people head north. And as you know, with Florida, you can't go any direction other than head north. So that's kind of a situation that, you know, we're seeing a lot of people head north. But I think that we're in fairly decent shape in terms of travel arrangements. I know the airport's very busy. But right now, you know, we still have 36 to 48 hours where we can, I think, still operate flights. And so I suspect every plane leaving here is full. At the end of the day, there's been plenty of notice with this storm. And, you know, going back, I've been here all my life. And this storm is probably as well publicized and as well, we've kept the public as well informed as any storm before. Part of it is because of how just big and bad and broad this storm is. But we've had plenty of time to educate and inform our neighbors and visitors of the potential impact of this storm.
Are you going to stay in Fort Lauderdale?
Oh, absolutely. I'm actually out here with what I think is the best city staff in the country. We've got our police, fire, public works, public utilities, public information. We're hunkering down at the EOC. I'll be going throughout the city over the next 72 hours, checking out neighborhoods, especially focused on low-lying neighborhoods. The one group that can't leave is government, and our job is public safety. Our job is keeping people safe and secure, whether they're here, and if they depart, we got to keep their property safe and secure. So as mayor of Fort Lauderdale, I'm proud to be working with just some of the top management and staff of any municipality in the country.
That's Jack Seiler, the mayor of Fort Lauderdale. Mayor, thank you and good luck. Let's hope that this storm makes a turn back out to sea. But if it doesn't, best of luck with it.
Thank you very much, and certainly appreciate you all keeping us in the loop and keeping everybody informed as they listen to your show. So thank you so much.
Well, here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.